Hi everyone, this episode contains discussion that some viewers might find disturbing. If you are affected by anything, you can find links to sources of support in the description below.
Any of us experienced some form of sexual assault? Because I have.
I have.
Yes, I have.
That's all, that's 100%. That just shows you how common this is. Like when people say, oh, but it's not but. There's still us in this conversation.
Anissa.
And I'm Luanda. Welcome to the third episode of Ethnically Speaking. We are four brilliantly intelligent, curious, and opinionated women represented in the UK. We are here to talk about anything and everything affecting our communities, from pop culture to politics and everything in between. Nothing is off limits, and we always promise to keep it 100% real. So forget tiptoeing around topics and technically speaking, because today we are ethnically speaking. So guys, if you haven't watched the second episode from last week, stop everything you're doing and head over to there now. We had a passionate debate about poverty in the UK, about the racial pay gap, and about the representation of Black women, at which point some tears may have been shed. But you have to watch the episode to find out for yourselves and make sure to let us know what you think. So, Sophie, what is on your mind today?
Well, you know that coronavirus has pretty much changed the entire way that our world is working. Now, in Britain, we've been in lockdown since March, I think. And in the past few weeks, we've kind of seen a lifting of the restrictions. But Boris Johnson, our Prime Minister, came out last week and said that we are massively lifting restrictions from this Saturday, July 4th. So restaurants, pubs, hairdressers are going to be opened. I'm very happy about the hairdressers. My husband has not had a haircut since March. I kid you not. So, very excited. But when we're seeing lots of people going to Bournemouth Beach, when we're seeing the Brixton block parties, the Notting Hill block parties, I'm really wondering, do you think that the public can be trusted to keep the social distancing expectations, or do you really think we're heading for a second wave of infection? I don't know. What do you think, Anissa?
Do I think the public can be trusted? Absolutely not. I'm saying it's that simple. I absolutely do not think they can be trusted, because we shouldn't have been trusted in the beginning. You know, it's kind of how we got into the whole lockdown mess. I just think we cannot be trusted, and I think that has been illustrated in, as you've said, the Brixton block parties, the Notting Hill block parties. But not only just that, like, of course we've all seen what's happened last week when the weather was lovely and it was booming. Everyone was out on the beach and there was no social distancing in sight. Like, everybody was just like around each other spreading germs, and I think we're going to start to see the ripple effect of social distancing, not like now that people are laxing on it. I think we're going to start to see the ripple effect, because I don't know if you guys have seen, but they're now considering putting Leicester in a local lockdown because the rates have spiked back up in Leicester. So now they're thinking about just locking down Leicester again. And this is all because people one report said this, and I don't know how true it is, but they said it's because people were crowding around outside of takeaway shops. No, I don't know.
That's offensive to people in Leicester. I just want to say that. They're not the only place that has takeaways.
Honestly, so I thought that was a bit... To bring it back down to that point, I was like, wow, like what goes on in the takeaways in Leicester? But anyway, I think... So we've seen that in Leicester already, they're going to have to go back into lockdown, just them, because they haven't social distanced well. So that illustrates my point. I'm just saying, I don't think we can be trusted.
I think that's what my issue is with what Boris Johnson has been saying in terms of some cities are going to be locked down. Because how do you lock down a city? Are you going to say that all the shops will be closed and people can't leave Leicester? Or people can't go into Leicester? Or my shops in Leicester will be closed, but the shops in Birmingham are open, so you can travel there. I'm like, how? You can't even envision. Like, the government regulations have been so vague. I don't understand. In America, it makes sense, because a state is like a country. So if the state is locked down, it's going to be much easier to kind of stop crossing the border and things like that. But this Leicester thing, the shops haven't even opened yet and they already said there's a risk of infections. What do we think is going to happen when the rest of the country's opened up?
Here's the thing, right? I agree with both of you. Firstly, we never really went into lockdown to begin with. And not just thinking about everyday people, but our leaders, was it Dominic Cummings, who was driving up and down country, visiting someone and visiting that person? Do you know what I mean? Like, no one did lockdown properly. And the fact that we're saying that lockdown is open, is lifted, right? That in itself is just a funny sentence, because nobody locked down to begin with. The only thing that really happened was that that shops closed down. But people were going about their everyday business. People were still meeting up. People were going out, you know, and linking this person and that person and just paying that fine. People were still going about their business. The only thing I think that could happen with the Leicester lockdown is what they did in New Zealand and Australia. So they had police actually at state borders, which prevented people from coming in and coming out.
How can they do that? I think that's going to be impossible to do. Like, you're going to stand at every motorway exit for Leicester and be like...
They're serious. They don't have that many exits. Leicester's small, isn't it?
Which isn't it? I don't know. But they're going to have to, and they may have a tick list of who is, you know, doing deliveries that can be there, and any wanderers get turned back. Wanderers. That's the only thing they can try and do.
What do you guys think of the 1 meter rule? Because, well, it is the 2 meter rule, but I know that hotels and pubs came out and said, with the 2 meter rule, we can only have capacity at 30%.
Oh my God.
If you change it to 1 meter, then we can have 70% capacity. So now they're bringing in, you can only be 1 meter apart if you can. But I saw an article in the BBC News and it was saying that by taking it down to 1 meter, it's actually increasing the rate of infection by 2 to 10 times. So for me, I'm just like, okay, how is this going to work? Like, do we really think that people are going to be in pubs and they're going to have a couple of drinks and then they're going to stay distanced from each other? Like, what do you guys think about that?
That part. I agree with Anissa when she said I definitely don't trust the public to do anything. I'm the same way. I really don't. And I mean, like, I was out the other day and my personal space got invaded by two men. In the space of in the time span of 20 minutes, two of them, guys. And here's me thinking that, you know, I can finally walk around and be female at the same time. And people are going to finally respect the distance. But it doesn't happen. So my naivety was shattered when I realized that individuals are individuals and individuals are going to do what they want to do. Like Linda said, I personally did lock down, but one of my friends called me Luanda, what have you been doing? You've just been at home. And I'm like, yeah, that's what we're supposed to be doing. And it's just like, I've been to 15 house parties, girl. What are you doing? Okay. And I think you see it, you know, with what happened in Brixton the other day as well, just to give some context to that for anyone that doesn't know, there was a large gathering of people and a lot of loud music. It was actually labeled as an unlicensed music event, and then the police came obviously to try and enforce social distancing measures, and there was a massive clash between the people of Brixton and the police. And I don't know if you guys saw these videos, yeah, but some people whipped out swords. Like, I saw a man whip out a sword. He did samurai warrior moves on the police. I was so confused. Like, you just had that in your house. Someone said, do you want to hit up the function? I was like, yeah, I'm just grab my sword to bring it. That confused me. But I think also, in terms of that, in terms of the clash that happened in Brixton, there was a leaflet advertising a Black Lives Matter musical protest. Mm. And I think that's being connected to the riots, when I personally don't think that they are connected, just because the musical protest was really peaceful. People were literally, there was one microphone, people were reciting poetry, people came with flowers in their afros, and people social distance, and it ended at 7 p.m. But I think that people are very comfortable with associating the Black Lives Matter movement with destruction. So as soon as they saw that leaflet of an event that was happening on the same day, even though it was hours before the riots happened, people were like, oh yeah, look at those people, that's what they're doing, that's what's going on. Although, having said that, I do believe that the clash between the people of Brixton and the police I understand that people are frustrated with the lockdown measures, but I think it was way deeper than that. I don't think people were throwing bricks at police cars because of, you know, the things, the restrictions that are placed upon us right now. And, you know, Brixton has a long history of rioting. And I think that, I can't remember who it was that said that a riot is the language of the unheard. So I think that we should kind of be focusing on what they're trying to say.
Good thing. Okay. So I agree. Like, for me, the way that they interacted with the police, for me, I think it was unforgivable. I can understand, but mashing up cars, doing things like that, like, when it, I don't know if I can really say those people were trying to make some sort of protest movement. I don't think it was. I think that people were having a good time. Maybe people were drinking, things got carried away. But in terms of like the racial aspects, I was just very glad that there were a lot of white British people at Bournemouth. Because I'm just like, at least not going to be getting blamed for coronavirus and the protest, because Bournemouth Beach was a madness. Like, honestly, I was just like, this is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And I think I understand why the economy is trying to be opened up, because a lot of money has been lost. Like, my sister-in-law-to-be, she's supposed to get married in September. We don't know if that's going to happen. So for some people, it is benefiting them opening the world up. Like, there's small business, there's people who do need to open up. So from that aspect, I can see why for a lot of people, this is actually a good thing. But I think the health risks are still there.
Same. I agree. And even just following on from what Luanda said, I think it's really just going to come down to the individual and how responsible they want to be for everybody else. Yep. Because, like in America, whatever, they were saying that all the Black Lives Matter protests was going to create a spike or whatever back in the coronavirus rates. And then they did a study, I guess now, I think it was last week, I can't remember who did it. And they found that there wasn't an increase in a rate of coronavirus from the protest. So it was showing that people were socially distancing responsibly and there wasn't a spread. And of course, that was in the US. So I'm hoping what mimicked in the UK is, even though people have been in large group settings, if they individually wanted to be responsible for themselves, then they would have socially distanced and we won't see a spike. I mean, yeah. I can't talk about the people at Bournemouth Beach because I don't know what they were doing. But the people at the protests, I'm really hoping that they were being responsible and socially conscious all at the same time, and that we won't see, because I want to have faith in people. I want to say, like, yeah, we can trust them, but I know the harsh reality, so it puts me on the line of, we can't trust them, but I still want to believe in them.
Do you know what I think the issue is? There are still people out there that don't think coronavirus is real. Yes. There are still people that think that it's some kind of ploy and some kind of... I personally, at the end of March, I had symptoms that I'm pretty certain were COVID-19. Oh, I'm pretty certain Rona came and stepped to me. I lost my sense of smell. She did. Rona came, you know. Rona came to me to pay me a visit, an unwanted visit, yeah. I lost my sense. I didn't clock that I'd lost my sense of smell until my sister had texted me telling me that she had lost her sense of smell. And I'm sitting there with my boyfriend, and I'm like, hold on, can I smell anything? So I went to his bathroom, sprayed like his aftershave on my hand. I'm like, oh my God. I smell. So that's when I clocked. Okay, cool. And that whole sinus situation. But thankfully, I could breathe, you know, and it went within a few couple of weeks or whatnot. But I think that is part of the problem. People don't believe coronavirus is real. So they're like, why am I going to social distance? And why am I going to social distance? It's just the government trying to take away my liberties. Yeah. I think all this stuff in terms of social distancing and staying alert and preventing the spread of this disease, which is real, because I have spoken to countless of people who work in the NHS, and some of the things they've seen is just horrific. But I think it starts with us as individuals. And now when I go out, listen, I've got a couple of masks in African print. So I'll be doing COVID-19, making an African fashion, you know. You know what I mean? I think it starts with the individual. And I'm, you know, urging my friends. Like my boyfriend the other day, he told me he went to the park to meet some friends. I said, how did you get to that park? He said, public transport. I said, then we're going to have to talk, because you need to be driving everywhere straight, period. Do you know what I mean? I think, obviously, not everyone drives. I'm not saying people need to go now get a car. But I just think there's little things that we can do individually to, you know, prevent the spread.
I actually think that a second wave is slightly inevitable as well, for a couple of reasons. Well, if we have been socially distancing, we haven't been exposing our body to as many germs as it is used to. If you are only exposing yourself to the germs that are in your house and maybe you walk to the park and back, you know what I mean? So then I think it might be a little bit of a shock to the system when we go back to normal. But also, come winter time, our immune systems are lower anyway. You know, people are always talking about colds and this and that in winter, but it's just because, but we have colds in summer. We just, it's just not as as big, because our immune systems are better. So I think that being in winter, having our immune systems lowered, and then COVID kind of making its way around again, will be more susceptible to the virus. So I do think, and especially that having happened after the shock of going back to normal, all of those things are going to play a factor in the second wave. And I do think it will happen. I think it will happen around January. And I hope that I'm wrong.
You're optimistic. I think that thing is coming way sooner than January. Honestly, I think we're going to be opened up for a couple of months, but then it's going to come back towards December time. And it's not just our immune systems being lower. It's people who are already vulnerable. The old are already vulnerable in winter. They're already vulnerable to getting the flu. Then you're going to add this on. And I think my biggest issue with the lifting of the restrictions and Boris Johnson is that they haven't been clear on the fact that coronavirus isn't over. The lifting of the restrictions, the canceling of prime minister's minutes every day makes it seem like, oh, it's over. Oh, it's all done with. Oh, you can be a meter closer. You can go to the pub. You can do this. You can do that. It makes people not realize we are still in the middle of a pandemic. And I know he's been under intense pressure from the Conservatives and a lot of people, but it really seems like life has been graded a lot cheaper than money. Because I'm like, people are going to die, but you want to get money in. Your first priority is to make sure people are safe, and that's not what's going on in my opinion.
You need to say that again. She said, life is graded cheaper than money.
The thing is, there's actually a point that Luanda made that I want to expand upon.
Yeah.
You mentioned that when you were out and about, you had your personal space invaded twice by men. Now, I know this is going to gear us to a slightly different conversation, but just the idea of space and spatial invasion, right? So I don't know if you guys have seen recently, I know Ambush, there was a situation with Ray Black who accused Ambush of sexual assault. Yeah. Justin Bieber had been named as well, although he brought receipts and he's now suing the people who claimed it. We've had people like, what's his name from, is it Russell Simmons?
Death Jam.
Right, now a lot of men have been claimed or said to have invaded private space, you know, whether it be sexual assault, rape claims, there's a lot of things that are coming to light. Now, I don't know if you know, but the USA have a statute of limitations, whereas the UK don't. And a statute of limitations means that there is basically a time frame of which certain allegations or if you want to bring something to light and have it be prosecuted, it has to be done within a certain amount of time if it's a crime, etc. Whereas the UK don't have that. Do you think that there should be some kind of statute of limitations put in for women who want to come? I'm going to say women for now. I'm not going to say men have not experienced it, but I want to concentrate on women for now. Do you think there should be a statute of limitations for women who want to come forward with sexual assault allegations? And why do you think some women come forward with sexual assault allegations years down the line?
Oh, these are like big questions.
One at a time, girl.
Requires a lot of thought, and I guess not even just thought, it requires a lot of unpacking, if you will. I'll start with my yes and no answers and then kind of unpack. First of all, about the statute of limitations, I'm just going to say no. I just feel like whenever you're ready to speak your truth, or whatever it is that you need to say, I don't feel like you should have a time frame in which you should say it. I feel like you should always be able to say it and always bring it forward. So I'm just going to say no. And also for those who have been accused, it's like I always believe that anyone who's been accused of anything should get a trial, like just get a trial, a fair trial or any kind of trial. So for me, it's like, no, let's not have a statute of limitation so that the victim has time to come forward whenever they want to. And then the accused can also have a trial if to say what the situation is. Of course, I mean, I know the law is corrupt, but that aside, I just think like you have to have some sort of fairness to it. And then why do I think it takes time for people to come forward or women to come forward? That's a difficult one. I don't think there's any specific one reason. I think it's just a blend of reasons. It could be absolutely anything. it's such a tough subject, because you think about, it makes you have to think about your own personal experiences or the experiences of women around you, and maybe what they've done and what they haven't done. And like, when I was listening to Ray Black kind of go through what was going on with the ambush situation, and she spoke about her friend saying to her, like, don't do it because to like protect a black man and things like that. Like, that really struck a chord with me, because I felt like I was reading the same exact situation that had happened in my life. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, God, like, I don't want to hurt this black man, because I feel like I need to protect black men. So it's kind of like, but my thought process was like, bro, I'm having your back, but why didn't you have mine? Like, why'd you do it in the first place? Like, do you know what I mean? It was a bit of a tough one. And so it's like, it's really tough to unpack that. So I feel like women wait for so many different reasons. And I think the number one thing you kind of have to, like, the caveat of waiting or when you come forward, is you have to be comfortable and you have to be ready to speak. And I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with what's happened, and it takes them time to kind of just put together the pieces of what's happened. So I kind of sit on that.
Can I do a quick thing, Luanda, before you say anything? I just want to do a quick thing for anyone watching or listening.
Yeah.
Out of us four who are here right now, have any of you experienced, and if you don't feel comfortable going into detail, I'm not asking you to do so, but have any of us experienced some form of sexual assault? Because I have.
I have.
Yes, I have.
That's 100%. That just shows you how common this is. Like, when people say, oh, but it's not, but there's four of us in this conversation and each one of us have experienced this. No. Sorry, Luanda, go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah. You guys aren't trying to make me cry two episodes in a row. You know, ladies, stop it. It's not going to happen. I agree with you, Anissa, that I don't think there should be a statute of limitations at all. I think that sex is seen as something for a straight man to enjoy. Sex is seen as something that a straight man has a right to, something that he is owed, and something that he should not be denied. So when we look at the world like that, and then we have women, the thing that we are valued the most for is our sex appeal. That's the thing that you place them. Yeah, our desirability. That's the thing that you place most value on about us. And it's to me, like, it is so ridiculous. And I think that in terms of people who wait to come forward, we need to feel like there has been a space that's created that's safe enough for us to do so.
Sure.
And time again, the world that we live in proves to us that this is not that place. And so recently we have been seeing a shift in awareness, and we've been seeing a shift in victims being vocal. And a lot of the time these cases are from 10, 20 years ago, because even just then, there wasn't that conversation. There wasn't that openness where we could have a space to be like, okay, this happened and I'm not comfortable with that happened, you know? And also, we live in such a victim-blaming society. So like Anissa says, it takes you kind of a long time to unpack what's happened to you. Sometimes you're in denial about it. Sometimes if you were a child, you don't really realize what happened to you isn't okay. And sometimes you don't have the strength to speak out because you think that you're alone. But the thing that works so well with silencing is that when everyone's silenced, no one really realizes that we're all having the same conversation. We're all having the same experiences. And so it prevents you from then coming forward with your own, you know. Going back to our victim blaming society, a couple of years ago in Ireland, you guys probably heard about this case, but there was a 17-year-old girl that accused a 27-year-old man of raping her in a muddy alley. And the defense attorney for the accused brought up her laced thong in court to prove that she intended to have sex that evening. And I'm not saying that's the only thing that played a factor, but that man did get off. And then there was a bunch of resulting protests afterwards in Ireland. So, going back to the layers that... One second, girl.
No.
Going back to the layer that it adds being a black woman on top of that, I think that black women have a desire to defend and protect black men in a way that they don't feel the same for us, generally speaking. They don't have that same desire to defend and protect us, especially not dark-skinned Black women. So when you're a Black woman and you're coming forward with a case, especially when it's against a Black man, you're thinking about the community. You don't get to think of it on an individual level. And like you said, Anissa, with Ray Black, her friend was like, are you going to do that to a Black man though? And with Drew Dixon, who was one of the people who accused Russell Simmons, she's like, I didn't want to destroy the culture. And I love the culture. So I was scared of doing that. So I think that we have to take that layer of being not only approaching it as a Black woman, not as a woman, but as a Black woman as well. And there was someone else in that documentary on the record about sexual assault in the music industry. And she was a Black woman who said, we don't believe white women. We don't believe white women when they come forward. What do you think this world is doing for Black women? What do you think?
Nothing, not a damn thing.
I've got a joke in there. I think there's a lot of things. But in terms of, I think it's important for us to understand why people are saying to protect our Black men, because they're saying that our Black men already have the odds stacked against them. They're already seen as criminals. They're already seen as violent. They're already seen as wanting to take sex from people. And there's this notion that if we then come forward and say something against a Black man, all we're doing is piling on to a pile that society has already put onto them. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm trying to help people who might not understand the concept of protecting our Black men understand what does that even mean. That's what it means. It's like, they already have a tough time. Why are you going to add to it? I don't agree with that. Anyway, in terms of the statute of limitations, I don't know if I think that it should be thrown out completely, because I think about it in the... Linda, don't look at me like that, girl. I think about it in the sense of the law, when the law was put in place anywhere, the whole point of it was to protect the people. And law has to be updated as the society and the culture changes. Law wasn't just put in place. It should really be changing as the society changes. So the statute of limitations was put in to protect people so that people, and I'm not talking about sex offenders, I'm talking about in general, so that people don't always have to be fearful of the things that they've done. Let's say for people, when the London riots happened in 2011, people were getting 3 months in prison for stealing chewing gum. Let's say it's your little brother. Seriously, it was madness, because they were trying to set an example. So let's say one of our little brothers stole a TV. He was 15 at the time. And then 10 years later, he was never caught. He's now put his life together. He's going uni. He's done that. He's got a good job. And then suddenly they bring up this case from 10, 15 years ago. And they say, yeah, we're going to hold you accountable. The statute of limitations has been put in place to make sure that, taking into account, people can change. Not every crime needs to be prosecuted years and years on, because it doesn't give people the ability to kind of move away from what they've done in the past. Now, in terms of sexual, in terms of sexual assault and sexual issues, I think we have a problem there, because one of the reasons why people don't come forward, women don't come forward, men don't come forward, because I think we have to include men in this, because a lot of times men aren't included, and then there's a further stigma around coming forward and saying that they've been sexually assaulted. So one of the things is trauma. Trauma affects people in so many different ways. And with trauma, a lot of people, I read this article in BBC.com, and it was saying how a lot of people don't even feel like they have been raped. It takes a long time for people to even associate what has happened to them with rape. They're kind of like, well, no, he kind of put pressure on me. He removed the condom. But, you know, he said it slipped off. So, and there's a documentary, there's a program that's come out called I May Destroy You, Michaela Coel.
Yes.
Guys, you have to watch this. But it talks about sexual assault is so varied. A lot of people don't even know that they've been sexually assaulted.
Yes.
Someone's forced to kiss you. Someone's dry humped you against your will. Someone has forced you to have oral sex. Like, it's so varied. People don't know their rights. And then when they know, they're like, well, then that thing that my boyfriend did to me was sexual assault, and I didn't even know. So I think there really needs to be a lot of education around what is sexual assault, what are your rights? Because when we think of rape, and I asked my husband this today, I said to him, babe, when you think of rape, what do you think of? He was like, someone in a narrow alleyway being held down and forced to have sex. And I'm like, and that's the issue. When we make that rape, everything else that comes before it, someone touched my breast and I didn't want them to. This guy rubbed, this is a true story, this guy rubbed my bum in a picture twice And I didn't say anything because friends were there and I'm like, are they going to believe me? It was really awkward. Maybe I misinterpreted it. That's sexual assault. Yeah. And when you start letting these things know, then you can start to be like, come forward with it, because it's not just intercourse, forced intercourse, that's rape. There's a plethora of things that are against the law.
Right, so I want to jump in real quick. I agree with a lot of what you said. My thing about the statute of limitations is I think that when the crime involves another person,
yeah,
such as things like sexual assault, rape, murder. I'm not too sure about GBH and ABH, depending on, you know, the severity. But I feel like certain crimes shouldn't have statute of limitations, like rape and assault and murder. I think because that's, and yes, the person that you were 10 years ago may not be the person that you are today, but I feel there has to be some acknowledgement, repercussions for being that person at some point. You know, and I say it, even using the example that you use of, God forbid, my younger brother's doing something of that nature, and, you know, in 10 years' time. But you know what? Examples have to be set. And the reason why I think these examples need to be set is referring back to the case that Luanda mentioned, the fact that this girl's underwear was picked up and used against her. So we're teaching girls, oh, do you know what? Don't dress in a particular way. You don't want to encourage men. But are we teaching men what consent is? Are we teaching men that just because someone is dressed a particular way, not the men, are we teaching boys? We teaching boys, don't touch that girl that way? Yeah, we're teaching that girl, no, don't wear a short skirt to school because you don't want boys looking at you. But are we teaching that boy, don't look at that girl whether or not she's wearing a skirt? Like, this is why I feel like these particular crimes need to face some kind of repercussions, whether it's 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, a year later. I'm not gonna lie, when Jimmy Savile's case came out, I did think, the only reason why I thought, why is it coming out now, is because he's dead. And because he's dead, he cannot face those repercussions. That's the only reason why I'm like, you know, if you have the strength in to do so, bring out these allegations or bring out these vile things whilst the perpetrators are still alive, so that they can be the ones to face it and not necessarily their families. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Other than that, I don't think there should be statute of limitations.
Let me just clarify then. I think for violent crimes, there shouldn't be a statute of limitations.
Yeah.
Like, but I'm talking about the reason why statute of limitations was brought in. Because it does need to protect some people sometimes. I'm sure all of us know somebody who did some madness when they're young and changed their life around. And
you want
that thing to be brought forward. I think in terms of violent crimes, I think there needs to be a statute of limitations. But we see in America, even certain states have updated things as this information has come forward. Because it was only in 1991 in the UK it was made illegal for a man to rape his wife. Before that, before 1991, they said it was generally believed, but if you're married, it's not rape because you're married. And 1991 in the UK, so now the law has been changed. And that's why I'm saying laws need to be updated. They said in California, it was only since Bill Cosby that they have now thrown out the statute of limitations for sexual assault. Because they were like, a lot of women came forward for various reasons. Women come forward and people don't believe them. For Jimmy Savile, people come forward, but people, it's not, as Luanda said, it wasn't the right time. The Me Too movement has shifted things exponentially. So now women are being listened to. Also, I think in Michigan as well, there was another claim there, so that the statute of limitations was extended for children. So that it was before that, it was up to 19. If you didn't come forward as from child abuse up to the age of 19, they wouldn't hear you. Now they've extended that to 29, plus a few years on, and they're trying to make it wider because of a specific case. So I think with America, it's very difficult. Because every state is basically a country, they all have separate laws. For them to try and change the law across the whole of the United States, it has to be taken up to federal law and all of that. Every state should be looking to update their laws to serve the people of the state.
I think also that, like, with going back to the law and things like that, and it's frustrating when people are like, oh, well, if that happened to you, then why don't you talk about it? Why don't you come forward for it? I don't really think people understand how traumatic the process is, almost worse or almost as traumatic as the incident that happened to you, because you are then going to have to go to strangers, multiple strangers, and recount all of those details, every single detail, inch by inch, like, not like when you're telling a story to your friends, you're like, oh, this happened, blah, 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 you exaggerate, you have some fun, you laugh. inch by inch, you will digest that story and then you will do it again. And then you'll do it again. And then you'll go to court and you'll be treated like you're lying. So that it's going to happen again. It's like you're like, all of that can sometimes be worse than actually just trying to heal alone, instead of like going through that whole process and being exposed. And like, you know how the, like, if that happened to me, if I went to court and they held up my underwear, like I would yeah. definitely go to jail for whacking that man across his face. Like,
yes, I'm with you.
It's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. So people, I think people need to have some more sympathy when they think about the way that these kind of things affect victims' lives, almost for the rest of your life, and the way that it will then unravel if you try to delve into it and try to speak to people who aren't sympathetic, maybe because it's their job to kind of just get the information and then goodbye, or then people who are who it's their job to make it seem like you're lying because they're trying to get their client off, you know. But Anissa, I think you're going to say something. Sorry.
Yeah, no, right. I was just going to say, like, the whole topic about coming out is just an interesting one. Like, I had a topic with my friend, and it was just explaining to him that it's not always easy to come out from a woman's perspective.
So I think there's a lot of unlearning that men have to do just because society has taught them to go after women in a certain way and things like that. So there's a lot to unpack there, and I'm sure us lovely ladies want to talk more about it. But whilst we have all you lovelies watching, do not forget to like, to subscribe, and make sure you comment. Let us know what you're thinking, what you're enjoying so far, and what your thoughts are.
Okay, so slightly off the conversation, the 22nd of June just passed, and that was Windrush Day. I don't know if you guys know much about it, but that marks the 72nd anniversary that the Empire Windrush ship came into England. And of course, it was carrying hundreds of West Indian migrants. So the whole point was that they came to the UK after the World War II to help basically rebuild the country. And that was like things like building the network rail and things like that, just to help rebuild the country and all the damage it has been through. Basically, we all know about the Windrush scandal that happened a couple of years ago. Prince Charles has been quite public. He's on record stating this, that the British public owe a debt of gratitude to the Windrush generation. However, we all know what happened with the Windrush scandal and how that unfolded. And now, more than 2 years on from this scandal, we found out that estimated only 60 out of 12,000 people that were eligible for compensation because of the Windrush scandal have actually received payment. So the disparity between that is ridiculous. So I'm just thinking to myself, like, are thanks and payment pledges, it rattles me because it touches quite close to home and obviously with my family and things like that. But are thanks and payment pledges, are they an adequate compensation for the Windrush generation? Or should the government be doing more? Like, I know what I think about it, but I'm curious to kind of see what you girls think about it. So, Linda, what do you think?
Firstly, that thank you is worth nothing, okay? That thank you is just...
talking, Anissa, Linda was just like...
words out, because I don't know how I feel about it, and it's just like, it just overtook me. But Linda, what do you think?
No! Listen, those words of thank you are comfort to a fool, okay? That is nothing. That is absolutely nothing. Where they need us to start with, see the pledges? The repayments. First and foremost, do you know what? Before we even get to money, how about we just take time and bring the people back that you have illegally deported? Yeah. Have you forgotten? They actually illegally deported people that came here to help this country. So how about you stop your shit? I'm sorry, right? Stop the bullshit. Stop the red tape. Go and bring these people back. Like, what is the long thing? You have their details. You know where you ship them to. Bring them back. How about that? And when you bring them back, literally pay them back as well. That is not good enough. I'm so sorry. The thing is, I'm not even Caribbean. Yeah, but it's just like, are you kidding me? Like...
just like Anissa was saying, this is close to home to me as well, because I'm Caribbean on both sides of my family, and I'm a direct descendant of British settlers, right? The thing that was quite painful for me was that growing up, black in England, I was never, and this is something that I recognise very actively as a child, I was never treated like I was supposed to be here ever. So I grew up always thinking that maybe I'm supposed to be somewhere else. So when I learned that not only did my family have a right to British settlement, not yeah. only did they have a right to settle yeah. in Britain, because the Caribbean countries that we came from were part of the British colonies. Yeah. So not only did we have a right to settle here, but we were invited.
Say it again. You invited
us here. What, that literally blew my mind. So 1000%, I think that there needs to be more done for people who were like unfairly affected by these racially motivated mistakes in terms of the Windrush scandal. But also I think that there's a bigger conversation that we need to be having. And I think that it's not just about looking about rectifying the mistakes that happened to those people. I think we actually need to be talking about reparations on a wider scale, okay? Yes. When you commit a genocide against a people, the reparations say what we have done was unjust. We acknowledge that we have done it, and we are trying to repair the communities that we destroyed. So when slavery was abolished, the people, that the companies and the businesses that would have lost the profit from trading in bodies were compensated for their loss when they abolished slavery.
Wasn't it until 2015?
Slave owners.
They were paying.
Slave owners.
They were paying them back. But it's not just slave owners, though, Sophie. It's like some banks and some businesses. So it's a lot mixed in there. And a lot of them are still running today. Yeah. And they were like still, so they decided, okay, we need to compensate the people who were, would make a loss for the profit that they would have earned from trading bodies. But they never thought to compensate the bodies and the descendants of those bodies that were traded.
Yeah.
So if we look at the Second World War, when Hitler was defeated in the Second World War, the next government that took over in Germany said that we owe reparations to Jewish people in the Jewish community. They paid 3 billion German marks to Israel, and they paid 450 million German marks to an organization, I forget the name of, it's like the World Jewish something, which is a made up of international Jewish businesses and communities and things like that. 450 million, 3 billion, big, big, big numbers. Obviously, it was paid over a period of time. And with us, we, like you said, Linda, we only just recently finished paying off the debt that was owed to people who were making profit off of trading bodies in 2015. And no one has looked at compensating the bodies that you were trading and the descendants of them. So I think that you need to, if you, you need to look at the root of your problem before you can think that you're going to solve all of the other issues that stem from it. Because for me, all roads lead back to colonialism. All roads lead back to the slave trade. And we haven't correctly solved that yet.
I 100% agree with you, Lorandra. And I just want to be clear. I don't think thanks and I don't think payment pledges, I just don't think they're enough. You know, Linda said it earlier. And, you know, the great thespian that is our prophetess, Prophet Sean Paul, said, "A sorry is a comfort to a fool." So, okay, let me tell you, okay? Sorry, I don't need a sorry, I don't need a thanks, I don't need that. And I understand you want to throw money at it, but money for me isn't enough, because for me, it's not just about the deportation. There's a bigger construct to it, because when the Caribbeans were invited keyword to the UK, it wasn't like packaged to them like, you're coming to the UK and you know, like you're gonna, it basically wasn't packaged to them like, this is a new country and you're helping to rebuild it. Like, they were told they were going to rebuild it, but the way it was brought to them was, you are coming to help your mother country. So the way that West Indians referred to England was, it was always called the mother country. So their belief was, we are one nation then. We're not Jamaican and they're British. we're one nation, we're an extension of them. So it for them is an extension of their identity, and they came over to help their mother country. They'd already been helping the mother country in the war. This is just, of course they're going to do that. That's what's going to happen. And they came here and were just met with completely the dreams that they had been sold was just, it was on ridiculous levels. And now we're saying years later to the descendants of this generation, right? Okay, oh yes, your parents and your grandparents came over here and this was their mother country, but actually you don't even belong to us, so we're sending you back. It is breaking down their identity and everything that they've been rooted in. So for me, money can't be enough and thanks can't be enough, because you now doing this in this social climate that we're in, to me, there's a bigger thing. The Home Office here has an agenda, and the Home Office, you would come after me if you like, but I believe you have an agenda, because I'm so passionate about this, because in the 70s, they passed some new immigration acts, right? Some new laws. And basically they said, okay, everyone who came over the Windrush, you have indefinite leave to remain if you stay in the UK. But what the Home Office didn't do was they didn't keep a record of all the people that were here. And so that for me was already, okay, that's a bit of a negligence.
They but didn't keep.
It was on purpose. And now we are full circle back to say, well, you don't have any papers, so now you need to go. It's a full circle. It's an agenda. And they don't care about us. That's why they had those buses saying, go home. Do you know what? Someone else talk, because I'm so furious.
You know what? Let me come in there, because I think that, I don't know. In terms of the story of, like, the Windrush scandal, because I don't know if everybody knows what it was, but obviously there was this hostile policy brought in by the government, by Home Secretary or Foreign Secretary, and the whole idea was to make it difficult for people who were here illegally to stay, and they started rounding up people who they didn't have transcripts or landing cards, and not even that some of the stuff wasn't kept in 1971. It was a couple years ago that the Home Office got rid of a lot of these transcripts and landing cards and ship cards, and people said to them, if you get rid of it, we're not going to be able to trace back how a lot of people came into the country. Mm-hmm. They got rid of it, and then they said to people, you need to prove that you need to prove your right to stay.
They went after low-hanging fruit.
They did, and even though we say, oh, we're outsiders in this country and this, that, and the other, we say that, but I still very much see myself as British. Because if I go to Jamaica, they're not going to say I'm Jamaican. I tell you that from now. They're going to be like, British girl. And I spoke to my dad. I asked him, I was like, Dad, when did you come here? He was like, I came here in 1962 on his British passport from Jamaica. And I was like, oh, do you think you'll go back? He was just like, why? He was like, that's not my home anymore. He was just like, my children are here. My grandchildren are here. What am I going back for? So when we're talking about ripping people from the only life that they have known for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, it's not even about saying going back to your home country, because you're like, this is their home. They have literally put down roots. They have paid taxes to pay back slave owners who hold their ancestors. That's how deep it gets. So there needs to be, I'm happy for the thank you. I'm like, Charles, I'm grateful for that thank you. But what are we going to do now? It's nice to hear it. I'm happy to hear thank you. But what are we going to do now? Because in terms of the reparations, I wasn't always I wasn't always someone who believed in reparations. I was just like, I just feel like, I don't know if it's going to happen. We just need to leave it and move on. But over the years, as I've done more studies, I'm just like, well, actually, no, we are still feeling the after effects of what happened. They're still having difficulty. There's still institutional racism. Like, there needs to be some payback. You talked about the Jews. They also said Japanese people who were in concentration camps in World War II
got money too. Yeah.
Money,
millions.
Like, this thing, because of us, we're going to pay you back. I think in terms of reparations, though, I think we need to find a way to do it constructively. And there was this article in the New York Times, and they were talking about reparations for America, but I think it still very much applies here, because they were saying we need to be looking at, you know, giving people from slavery maybe money off buying houses, money off education, money to start small business loans, money for medical insurance, like all these things that we can do to say, if you're not going to get a cash handout, how can we help you in areas that you are currently disadvantaged because you're not building on wealth for like 5, 6, 7, 8 generations that other people have in this country? And I think it comes down to a moral issue as well as a political one, because we want to say that, you know, it's in the past, it hasn't happened. But I'm like, but do you believe that people should be held responsible for the consequences of their decisions? Because that's what it comes down to.
100%.
That's what it comes down to. And that's what we don't want to deal with. We don't want to deal with, we were wrong. No one wants to say it was wrong. We want to say people, it was a bad time in our history. It shouldn't have happened. Take ownership.
People don't want to say it was wrong. People want to say it was done. They want to be like, oh, that was the past. You know, that's it.
Also, just even the fact that we refer to it as like
From the time you say something is wrong, you then have an obligation to fix it.
I agree, because I think that if you have a hand in the breaking of a community, you need to have a hand in the rebuilding of it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think even the fact that we call it like the Atlantic slave trade instead of the African genocide, which is what it was, just shows how important language is and how much we sugarcoat it and everything like that. And even when we learn the history, they're always trying to throw the blame to like the Spaniards or the Americans when it's England. It's England, you know? They love to just the thing is though, Sophie, with what you were saying about reparations, because you said, okay, we always talk about it in America, but it needs to be in England as well. I think that it is a global issue, because this has affected the African community and the African diaspora globally. So even if we look at, okay, maybe in England, the best thing to do would be looking at housing and education and things like that. But possibly in Africa, we need to be looking at having control over the things that we trade. Because the reason why Africa is seen as like a third world continent and things like that is because if Africa was to just only trade within their own continent and trade between the countries, we would be screwed. Even as we can see from having the conversation about Brexit a couple of years ago, how scared we are from leaving the EU and having that trade system. What would happen if Africa didn't trade internationally? All of the things that we use to make ourselves a first world country in the West and in most Western countries are not originating to our soil. So I think that you need to look at rebuilding the continent that you destroyed in the first place, because we're all displaced Africans. You can displace us to the Caribbean, you can displace us to England or wherever to America or wherever you want. But the original place that the genocide started at was Africa. And so you need to look at rebuilding that continent, especially when you had the biggest hand in destroying it in the first place. But but on the topic of African ownership, it is actually quite
it's not actually third world countries. I do work, my job is like in international development, so it's actually a developing country. So they're getting away from calling it a third world and kind of the country. So we're not first world anymore, it's a developing country.
And then, so we're developing, and what would you call countries in Africa?
So African countries would be developing countries.
Okay, and what do we call us?
Developed. So we have hit puberty.
We got our balls.
The third world comes with a stigma. It comes with like, you're kind of a third world. You're not with us. It's just like, no, they're still developing because of what you said has happened. And there's developed countries.
Yeah, I hear that. I think I appreciate all the time like switching of languages, like even the fact that we call ourselves minorities when actually like Black people are the global majority. So I think that everything that we say like has an impact on our psyche. So even growing up being Caribbean, I thought in my head, I didn't realize that Caribbean people were African people, and I thought that it was better to be a Caribbean person than it was to be an African person. So all of those things, they have an impact on the way that we view ourselves and on the internal power that it's harder to find when we're looking at ourselves as like a minority or a third world country or things like that. So yeah, I appreciate that, Sophie. What I was going to say was that on the topic of African ownership, there has been a debate that has been sparked a couple of weeks ago in terms of African wax print. So for me, that Linda said you called. People are actually saying that African wax print has less of a connection with African culture and more of a connection with colonization. So now that there has been such an encouragement for everyone to shop Black and support Black businesses, whether you're a Black person or an ally to the Black community, we should be looking at, you know, buying Black-owned things. And we're only now just realizing that even things that we think are Black-owned are not. So what do you guys think about still buying wax prints and things like that, even if they were created in different countries and manufactured in different countries, and the money kind of never circles back to the continent, do you think you're still supporting the Black community by doing that?
This one's a bit of a hard one for me. And I'll say it's hard. I'm going to be like wildly transparent. You know, I'd say recently knew what an African wax print was. And it's not because I haven't seen the prints before. I just didn't know what they were called. So it was like, okay, this is what they're called. I did a little bit of research into it because, as I said, I wasn't wildly familiar. But I saw that there were some manufacturing companies on in the mainland, like GTP and Woodin and things like that, but that they were owned by a group in the Netherlands called the Vlisco Group. And then the Vlisco Group were then acquired by a UK company for 151 million. And of course, none of the ladies in West Africa or in the markets, whoever sold it, never got any kind of money from the shares. But they apparently, the Vlisco Group, what they do is they go to the women in the market and they sit with them and figure out like what the latest trends are and what the buying state is and who's buying and when they're buying and what they're buying, so they can go back and make all the prints. And I thought, wow, they're just taking so much from the land. It's actually horrific because it's not benefiting the person.
The thing about African material is that it's more than just wax print. You have things like kente, which is Ghanaian. You have asoke, which is Nigerian, Yoruba, Igbo, whatnot. You have, I don't want to speak on other countries, but I don't know every single country there is in Africa, but you understand what I mean. There are traditional African materials that are traditionally made in Africa. The issue is that because they might not necessarily have enough finance, they're not able to then export and have those materials bought here in the UK. So companies like the companies Anissa mentioned, they do go there, they do their research, they try and buy. I'm thinking if I've got a wax print to show you guys, because even this dashiki that I'm wearing, I won't lie to you, this dashiki, I did buy it in a Nigerian shop. But whether or not it was actually manufactured by a Nigerian company, I probably don't think it was, you know. But things like dashiki, I don't even think are really African. They're just part of the African craze, you know. Yes. And that's how I think of wax print. When I think of the real material that my mum be wearing, like George's and Boba and Hollanders, when she starts naming me things like that, I'm like, yes, those are very, very Nigerian. But when I think of wax prints and I think of dashiki, I just think of that fake kind of Africa that everyone wants to celebrate, I want to be part of, that ain't really rooted anywhere, you know. But I think for me, when I buy materials that are, you know, traditionally African, I do buy them from someone who looks like me. And I think the short-term benefit is that my money goes to them. The long-term could be that if they get enough business, they might now be able to go and create their own manufacturing company. They may now be able to make this themselves and start actually taking over where some of these companies are coming from. So I think the short-term support can actually lead to long-term support as well. Because unfortunately, Rome wasn't built in a day. So I will still continue to buy. Don't get twisted. I'm one of those Brixtonites that you guys spoke about that were having those raves that I did not go to, by the way. I did not go to any of those raves. But, you know, there are Asian men in Brixton that sell material. And I won't lie, I kind of intentionally don't go there. You know, I want to go to my auntie's shop. You know, when I say my aunt, I don't even mean my relative. I mean a Black woman's shop to buy these things from. So I think the short-term support can actually yield long-term benefits.
Like, I was reading an article, or a link to an article on Instagram just this morning, and it was talking about how it was talking about colonialization and how that affected an industrial revolution happening in the continent of Africa. And I think we see that now, where a lot of things aren't manufactured within the country, even though they benefit. So you have countries like you were saying, Anissa, in like China, who will make print, because we know everything's made in China. Like, their industrial system is the best, one of the best in the world. They can make things so cheaply, and then they're shipping it back to these countries. And I saw that there was actually a manufacturing company in Ghana that was making prints, but they were saying they were getting heavily undercut by other people who are importing because they can do it for cheaper. And that's where we think it's affecting the economy, because it helps the woman in the shop who's selling it, but obviously we're talking about the major profits aren't going to them. And even though it is something from colonialization, as like you said, I didn't know this either, and I have a lot of African prints. I've traveled around the continent for work and my other job, apart from this. So I travel around the continent and I always try to buy some local print, because for me, it's always made me feel centered in the culture and feel like, do you know what? I am a displaced person from this continent. And I don't think, for me, I can only say this as a Caribbean person, it's not about me stopping wearing print, because I think print is now so heavily integrated within African culture. To say that I'm not going to wear it because it's colonialization, I'm like, I don't even think you can separate it now. It's so ingrained. It's so, and I was reading something that said, like, the print tells stories. Yes. Some of the has talked about things that have happened in the culture, the way society has moved on. Like, it tells a story. But for me, it's about trying to get the money back into the country now. Yes. And I feel like we're still seeing a continental rape of Africa. Like, we're seeing a cultural rape 100%. Of Africa still. Like, we're talking about when slavery happened, you know, they were stealing, like, the gold and the metals and the ore and all of that. But I went to Swaziland, which is a country in South Africa, mm-hmm. literally right next to South Africa. Swaziland, a small little place. And we were going to a safari park, and one of our people on our team who was born in the country, he was showing us a place where they're, I think it was taking copper. I think they have like a lot of copper ore. And I was just like, that was so great. Like, people can find work. He was like, not really. He was like, the king of Swaziland has a deal with the Chinese people. So he'll take the first cut and then China will take the rest, and China send over workers to mm-hmm. work in there so they won't even hire local. He was like, it actually has no benefit to our country whatsoever. And for the local people, apart from the king. And stuff like that is where I think the change needs to be happening, in terms of, you should not be allowed to come and put things in our country that doesn't benefit us. Like, you're trying to literally, you don't even wear these prints in China. You don't wear it in Asia. You don't wear it. So you should not be using it just to make money when it's linked to our culture. Because for me, it's cultural appropriation.
Oh, yes. Mm.
I think just to give a little bit more context in terms of the wax prints being connected to colonialism, the idea is that in Indonesia, there was a material called batik, which looks very similar to African wax print, and that the Dutch were inspired, because the Dutch had colonies in Indonesia at the time, in this specific island that they found the batik material, that they then were inspired to make like an African wax print. And they had West African soldiers working for them in those Dutch colonies in Indonesia. And the story is that apparently the African soldiers would have brought back those materials to the land, and that's how African wax print became a part of the culture. That's just one story. We don't know the whole truth, because, you know, I think there's the African proverb that says, tales of hunting is always told by the hunter, you know, like history is written by the people who win the wars. Yeah. So we have to take that one with a pinch of salt. But I do think that it's very frustrating when you think that you are representing your culture, and you think that, you know, you're being like pro-black with the things that you wear or the things that you do. And then you realize it has actually, like, the circulation of wealth actually doesn't reach back to the people that you want it to reach. Like, for example, when I was growing up, I used to use Dark and Lovely shampoo and things like that. And we, like, even as a child, the world that we live in was very, very different then. I can't think of one single person or like cartoon or something that I saw on the television that I felt represented by me. So the thing that I would look forward to is washing my hair, because on the bottle there was a little dark-skinned black girl who looked like me, and I was like, this is made for me. That's the first memory that I have of feeling like something has been created for me instead of something that I'm using despite it being created for someone else, which is the majority of things. So then to grow up and realize that Dark and Lovely is owned by L'Oreal, that was a little bit disheartening, especially because when you are creating things for black women or for the black community, but you have a business mindset, and by that I mean you don't have the interest of the community in mind, I think the quality of those products are not going to be to the standard that we deserve, because what you're thinking about is circulating the wealth going back to you and going back to your company and going back to your family. So there was even, you know, research on black hair products for black women that haven't been properly tested because they didn't care that much about it. And it turns out that there was a lot of damaging chemicals that could even lead to issues with your own brain. Like, I'm not even talking about your scalp, guys. Yeah. Your brain, God. Your mental health from these chemicals that you didn't test properly because you don't care about where it's going. You just think, we're going to throw it in that shop and black women are going to buy it because they need hair products. Mm-hmm. So things like that really frustrate me, because you want to not only buy something that was made with you in mind, but you want to also give money back to the community that is suffering. And it's really ridiculous to see how deep this goes. Yeah. I'm like, even the materials, guys.
Yeah.
We can't even have the, we can't even have a dashiki, like. We
but don't even, forget, guys, there are various textiles, though. There are various textiles when you are in places like in Africa that are originating in Africa and are woven in Africa. It's just these main kind of prints that are in the, it's a wax prints.
But then I read an article that was saying that they're struggling because of the competition. Because what I think Sophie was saying about how easy it is to manufacture in East Asia, because you're importing it here or you're creating it here, it's so much cheaper. And as people who are not like ridiculously wealthy, you're going to go for the cheaper products because you're going to try and save money. So like, we're going to go for this one because we can save however much money with this instead. So it's like, even the ones that have been created within the continent, like, they're struggling to make their business grow because of all competition.
But that's why what Sophie said in something we were talking about before, reparations, they're essential, because, like you said, the industrial economy in Africa is come on, you can't compare it to that of China's. But with reparations, things like that can be fixed and sorted, and we can have a fighting chance, because unfortunately we haven't been given one. Honestly, the only way I can see to actually mend the damage that has been caused to Africa.
Yeah, and for me as well, it's not even just, oh, let me, I'll go quick, Anissa, girl.
Because I've just got one quick thing. Go.
I was going to say, for me, and it's not even just about the reparations in terms of the continent of Africa. For me, it's like just leaving them now, even to just allow them to grow. And some places are, like, some of the wealthiest people in the world are in Nigeria. So let's not get it twisted, like, everyone's living in poverty. They are not. There are some very extremely rich people.
Very rich.
Of Africa. But very much still, Africa is still propping up Europe in certain ways and exporting things. My thing is, let them keep their wealth and all the things that they're growing and producing, so that they can actually start to make money off of this and not just continue to export it for our benefit.
Yeah, I was just going to say quickly that I came across last year a designer. Her name is, I hope I say it right. Her name is Eze. And basically, she's based in the UK, but she designs her own wax prints, and then she prints them up and makes them, prints the fabrics, and she makes them into head ties, and she sells them. Because I went to like a Shop Black event for Black History Month. And so she makes her own wraps and things like that. And when I was thinking about this topic, when I was thinking about this question, I was just thinking about Eze, because I was thinking to myself, like, I wonder what drove her to make her own wax prints. But I hope that what she's doing, or what everybody else will see, is that, you know, there can be some sort of reclaiming or ownership over the prints.
There we have it, guys. Episode 3 is a wrap. Thank you so much for watching. We have enjoyed every single second of today's show. If you're watching via YouTube, please do not forget to thumbs up this video, like and subscribe to stay up to date with everything that we are bringing you Ethnically Speaking. And we do want to keep this conversation going. We are building a family here. So please let us know, have you been buying black? Where have you bought from? Have you been affected by any of the topics raised today? Please do let us know. And for a summary of everything to do with today's conversation, don't forget to head over to unitedmelaningroup.com. We are definitely growing a family. Back again next week with some more fabulous conversation. And other than that, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you next week.